From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Monday, Christopher J. Dodd, the Democratic senator from Connecticut, told the Hartford Courant that he had, quote, decided to do all the things that are necessary to prepare to seek the presidency in 2008. On Tuesday, a New York Times story about Bill and Hillary Clinton's marriage sparked more pundit pap about Hillary's potential run. And Al Gore's global warming movie opened in select theaters, and there was endless speculation about his readiness for the stump. Ladies and gentlemen, it seems the 2008 Democratic presidential primaries are on.
Now, a new movie, a new Al Gore, and buzz about a new run for the White House.
Several sources close to the former Veep say a rerun is not unthinkable, but it is unlikely.
He's the darling of the left, especially the internet left now. If he sees this continuing over the next 6 months, I think he'll be there.
Do you buy this Al Gore resurgent? You know, is that for real, or is that just sort of the media latching onto something?
Does this create an opportunity on the left of Hillary in the Democratic Party that could end up being the explosive winner of the nomination?
Gore and Hillary can draw the media with little more than a tantalizing wink. But how do politicians on the fringe grab the spotlight? As Michael Crowley detailed in The New Republic, a small-time politician need only announce a run for president and the press can't help but swarm. Take former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel, absent from politics for over two decades. Last month, notes Crowley, Gravel drew an impressive audience of 50 reporters, including some from the Associated Press and the Washington Post, merely by tossing his hat into the 2008 presidential ring.
The bar is pretty low, as I think Gravel showed. I mean, in addition to those two reporters, he was also interviewed on Fox News. His press conference was carried on C-SPAN. He made a little rumble for a guy who's clearly not going to be a serious candidate.
But is he grandstanding for the sheer joy of it, or does he have some axe to grind?
He does actually have an agenda here, which is a kind of pet plan of his, which would involve ballot initiatives so that people could sort of vote on things that the government did, including, say, going to war. And he was going around giving speeches about this thing to some very, very fringy groups. And no one was paying attention. But as soon as he said, I'm running for president, suddenly he's in the Washington Post.
And of course, as you note, it's a great way to make money. Newt Gingrich hinted he was open to a presidential run after the release of his book. And of course, we know Colin Powell spent his entire book tour contemplating the race for president.
Colin Powell set the gold standard for this in 1996. He had just published a thick $30 autobiography and went on this massive book tour, I think, to about two dozen cities around the country. And at the time, he was publicly indicating that he might run for president. And the coverage, it was just astounding. And the book rocketed to the top of the bestseller list. And it was only after his book tour ended that he went off and kind of stroked his chin for a while and said, actually, I'm not going to run for president anyway. And Gingrich, as you mentioned, did something similar. He started talking about running for president, which was really a bolt out of the blue, right when he had a book coming out. Gingrich actually got a better reception than anyone expected. And I think now he's actually become kind of a serious candidate. I mean, in this weird way, sometimes people may wade into these things with one agenda and then realize, wow, people are taking me kind of seriously. Maybe I should really put my all into it and make this more than just kind of a media spectacle.
You think the press has a presidential fixation, don't you?
Oh, there's absolutely no question. I think political reporters just love presidential campaigns, and they want to see as many candidates as possible because that makes for more stories they can write. There's more conflict. They like to, I think, kind of build up rivalries that will be entertaining for them to cover. Also, I think that there's this very strange, almost kind of reality TV quality that's developed. It's kind of like the real world is more fun, you know, the more people there are living in the house and to fight with each other and, you know, do embarrassing things on camera.
In your article in the New Republic recently, you talk about a candidate, a well-regarded person, if somewhat on the margins, Gary Bauer, who couldn't collect a crowd no matter how he announced for president, while others, like Carol Mosley Brown, seem to be able to walk away from the Senate with the taint of ethical misbehavior and still get to run a campaign and get treated with all the respect that connects to a presidential candidacy.
Yes, well, it can be kind of random, and I think it goes to show that the media treats it a little bit like a circus. And someone like Bauer actually ran, I think, for reasons basically of principle having to do with his religious conservative views. But he just wasn't that entertaining. He was completely obscured by Alan Keyes, best known for having dived into a mosh pit that I think Michael Moore arranged at some campaign event in 1996. And the press loved him, and he got all this coverage, and he drew crowds as a result. And Bauer really couldn't get anyone to pay attention to his sort of fairly serious issue-based crusade.
Well, I brought up Carol Mosley Brown because I remember she was on the stage for a lot of the debates. Did the press ignore her previous mishaps the moment she entered the Democratic primaries?
You know, what do you do when you've sort of left public life under a cloud of shame? Well, you run for president because you can kind of launder your reputation through the media. You can recreate yourself. And when she finally left the race, after having never had a serious campaign, she was sort of hailed as having been a noble candidate who contributed to the debate and was such a pleasant person. And all these sort of terrible things about her seemed suddenly like kind of ancient history, like another chapter in her life. And I think one of the first things in her little bio says, you know, former candidate for president of the United States, Carol Mosley Braun, blah, 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 blah.
Should the media have the power to decide who's a real candidate and who isn't?
It's a very thorny question, and I wish I had a good answer. I think one thing that I would say is to keep in mind that the media does already do this, and the system right now rewards theatrics and outrageousness and not thoughtfulness. It would be nice if presidential campaigns generally were a little bit more about ideas and less about theatrics, less about jumping into the mosh pit.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Michael Crowley writes for The New Republic. 18 months before the 2008 election, the ducks are lining up and the front runners, Hillary Clinton and John McCain, are provisionally anointed. But how do the media know who to pay attention to when hardly anyone has actually announced a candidacy? Gerald Maserati is the editor of the New York Times magazine, which has already put two potential candidates on the cover, Democrat Mark Warner and Republican Chuck Hagel. But what about Bill Richardson and Barack Obama and Evan Bayh and Russ Feingold and Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney and John Sununu? When do they get theirs? Well, Maserati says that the Mark Warner cover story wasn't as much about a run for president as it was a position paper on Democratic centrism. Warner was just the hook.
If we wrote an 8,000-word abstract piece about what Democratic centrism has been, stands for, will be in the 2008 election, no one would show up to read it. You hang some of those ideas on a flesh-and-blood candidate, and you get readers. And so he's the representative of that idea. It really was meant to be a piece about ideas. Where the Democrats are, who the Democrats are, is a really, really interesting subject.
A perennial, I'd
say.
Yeah,
yes, it is. And I think as far as the magazine goes, that's what we're interested in. If we were a parliamentary democracy, maybe we could discuss these ideas outside of presidential politics. And we try, Lord knows. But the thing is, presidential politics is sort of where we focus our attention as a nation. It's how we sort of build a national politics. And it has huge shortcomings, of course, because it means that we're not very good at either as citizens or, I think, as journalists when it comes around to issues of governing. We like the politics part more than we like the governing part.
Getting back to the Mark Warner story, though, you can't really talk about Democratic centrism around a particular potential candidate without talking about the chances for that candidate, and hence the controversy over the cover, which evidently made him look like a used car salesman from the 70s, or as the New York Observer said, bearing a very strong resemblance to Mr. Ed.
Well, look, the cover picture, as it turned out, was a mistake, and I apologize for it. The photographer apparently used some sort of color filter that turned a blue shirt pink and a blue tie purple. I don't know what went on, and we didn't know about it. And when we knew about it, we went to correct it.
So let's talk about the Republican side. In February, you dedicated a cover to Nebraska's senior senator, Chuck Hagel. Was there an idea behind that? If Warner was the anti-Hillary, is Chuck Hagel the alternate McCain?
Well, I think the idea really came out of a conversation that Joe Lelleveld and I had. Was here's this Republican who is criticizing the war, who is concerned about the religious caste that his party has begun to have. Could this kind of Republican become president today? That's what we were thinking then. The story wasn't an early gambit to say, here's a dark horse presidential candidate.
But presenting him as you did, you certainly had to have in the back of your mind that he would be seen as a dark horse candidate, or at least that the New York Times would like him to be seen as a dark horse candidate.
Yeah, I would disagree that it's certainly with the idea that we would like him to be seen as that. He is someone who's talked about considering a run for the presidency. That's what got us there.
But by giving him a cover and presenting him so forcefully, conservative critics said that you were rewarding him for his anti-Bush views.
Well, anyone who doesn't like what we do is always going to be convinced that the doing of it was based on a secret meeting held in some bunker somewhere where a strategy was arrived at to do it. And of course, if you put out 52 issues of a magazine, you know that that's not how things come about. The cover is not an advertisement for what the New York Times believes about anything. The New York Times doesn't decide who to put on the cover. A small group of editors receive a number of pieces at a given time, and they pick among those pieces. These things aren't ordered up, though it is very difficult to convince some people otherwise. We don't make candidates. That idea that we have that kind of power either in the country or among the readers or anything is one of the great myths, a myth that serves a lot of people's interests. But we don't make candidates. We don't make presidents. We don't do any of that.
There's this candidate, a former legislator from Alaska named Mike Gravel, who announced. And the New York Times completely ignored him.
We're sorry about that.
But on a serious note, how come he doesn't make it into your pages?
Well, again, you know, if one of our contributing writers came to us and said a certain candidate deserves a piece because he or she is articulating an idea that is important to the party in a way that no one else is articulating, I think that would happen.
Well, Jerry, thank you very much.
It was fun talking with you.
Jerry Maserati is the editor of the New York Times Sunday Magazine.
Coming up, a TV channel for the coveted 0-2 demographic.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. At the end of last year, a 500-page report from the Institute of Medicine concluded that the $10 billion spent each year pitching food and drinks to kids is a critical factor in the alarming rise in obesity, type 2 diabetes, and other dietary-related health problems plaguing America's youth. This got me wondering about my own 5-year-old, so we took a field trip to the supermarket. Please note that while Ida is brilliant and adorable, she can't read. Oddly, that proved to be no handicap in the cereal aisle.
Tricks.
Tricks, right. And what's this one?
Marshmallow cereal. Yeah, Lucky Charms. And let's see, what else? What else do you...
Honey.
Golden
butter.
Grams, yeah.
Yeah, and there's also honey butter Cheerios.
Well, how do you know about all these?
I saw them on TV. Cocoa Puffs.
From this highly scientific study, it appears that advertisements are doing the tricks. I mean trick. But the Federal Trade Commission issued its own report earlier this month. The conclusion, self-regulation is enough to keep the advertisers in line, therefore keeping our increasingly overweight children healthy. Food companies fearing a crackdown breathed a sigh of relief, while health advocates felt the report did not go far enough. Michelle Simon is the director of the Center for Informed Food Choices, and she joins us now. Michelle, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
If toy makers and publishers are allowed to use Super Mario Brothers and SpongeBob SquarePants as licensed characters to sell their products, why shouldn't the food industry be permitted to use the same tactics to sell their stuff?
It's important to understand that young children don't even have the cognitive ability to conceptualize what marketing is. So they see SpongeBob in the program. A few seconds later, they see SpongeBob in a commercial. They have no idea that there's even a difference. Why do kids ask for, you know, macaroni and cheese? Because it's the box is splashed with SpongeBob. And that's the kind of exploitation that people are saying should stop.
But we're faced with the problem that these are legal products and we have a First Amendment. Are advertisers not permitted within the boundaries of truth to say more or less what they please to promote their products to kids or anybody else?
Just because the product is legal does not make the marketing around it legal. I really don't think our founding fathers could have anticipated that the First Amendment would be used to protect the likes of Kraft and Kellogg and PepsiCo to target young children.
Well, I'm not the world's best parent. You know, I have certain minor flaws. Yeah, I'll give you something to cry about, you know, that sort of thing. But I got to tell you, my kids are exposed to quite a bit of commercial television and commercial messages. And I've discovered that no is an extremely effective answer to any request for junk food. And they kind of learn to expect a no before they even ask the question.
Obviously, parents have to set limits, et cetera. But what role does industry and the government have to play as well in helping parents do as good a job as they can? And why are food companies undermining the ability to do a good job at every opportunity? You walk through the supermarket aisles, and it's no accident that all of the foods that are unhealthy for kids, the sugary cereals, the fruit rolls, the highly processed, high sugar, high fat items are placed at a child's eye level, 2 to 3 feet high, for kids to grab and yell to mommy, please buy me this. I mean, industry has a term for this. It's called the nag factor. A lot of marketing is going into the internet, and we've had to invent a new word, which is advergaming, which is a technique that companies use to embed advertising into internet games. So while companies like to point to parents, what they're doing is going behind parents' back, targeting children directly, and undermining parents' ability to be responsible.
Now, just by coincidence, last week I happened to spend some time with the head of marketing for McDonald's worldwide and with a big shot in Kraft's organization. And it was very clear to me that they have gotten the message, that they know that the public health crisis with childhood obesity and so forth has put a kind of pressure on them that they have never faced before. Have you seen anything more than a token recognition of what's happening, or is self-regulation beginning to actually work?
The food companies are on the defense. There's no question about that. Companies like McDonald's, Kraft, Coca-Cola have been responding. However, the way they've chosen to respond is basically window dressing. Kraft came out with this big announcement in January of 2005 saying they were changing their marketing practices towards children. How were they doing that? Were they going to stop marketing to kids? No. They were just going to shift some of their marketing dollars from some products into other products. Products like half the sugar Fruity Pebbles cereal. Now, most nutritionists will tell you that there's not much difference between regular sugared Pebbles cereal and half the sugar Fruity Pebbles cereal, especially when they make up for the sweetness with Splenda, an artificial sweetener, and the number of calories is the same. these companies understand that public relations is the name of the game. And so they're responding in a number of ways to make us all think that everything's fine, they're doing a good job, but the truth is it's just a bunch of PR.
Michelle, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Michelle Simon is the director of the Center for Informed Food Choices. She teaches health policy at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law. Food companies aren't alone in targeting kids. Entire TV channels like Nickelodeon and Boomerang focus on children. And now comes a new entry, this one especially for babies. Baby First TV became available via satellite this month through DirecTV, absent of advertising, for $9.99 a month. It's infant TV with a lineup that includes sign language lessons and videos of puzzle pieces putting themselves together. On the heels of the launch, the Kaiser Family Foundation released something of its own, a study showing that while 26% of parents say their children younger than two have never seen TV, a full 43% of children under two watch it every single day of their little lives. With that in mind, we called on Baby First's Executive Vice President Sharon Rector to see what they've cooked up for the under two set.
Everything we show is short segments. They're all 2 to 7 minutes long because that's the attention cycle of a baby. In essence, what Baby First TV does is we transform the television from a passive tool to an active tool that can help babies and parents interact. If, for example, you'd see on the screen a red ball bouncing, the subtitles for the parents would say, "Ask your baby what color is the ball."
Now, you knew that the launch of Baby First would precipitate a chorus of concern from those who say no amount of television is appropriate for babies. And I noticed in your board of advisors you have a pantheon of pediatricians and child psychologists lined up to defend the project. But is it hard to get around the recommendation from the American Academy of Pediatrics that kids under two shouldn't watch any TV?
I invite and encourage all those who say children should not watch TV to come and check out Baby First TV before they judge it. The AAP in its statement from 1999 did not differentiate between general TV, or if I may say, between the medium and the content. So based on their statement, a show like Sopranos would be the same like a show on Baby First TV, which is completely ridiculous.
Well, whatever the Academy of Pediatrics recommends, the fact is little kids do watch a lot of television. There's a report from the Kaiser Family Foundation on children's media consumption, which is kind of jaw-dropping.
Yep.
61% of kids under two watch TV or videos every day for an average of an hour. Is the idea here that if kids are going to watch TV anyway, they might as well watch something that, you know, that's not going to rot their minds?
The data is even more extensive than what we believed. 88% of babies under the age of three are watching television every day. We can speculate as much as we'd like on what babies should be doing or could be doing. But the fact of life is, as you mentioned, that babies are watching TV. And what Baby First TV offers is an alternative with programming that is tailor-made for the needs of babies, not for children, but rather for babies. And I can just quote one of the warm responses we've been getting from people who are viewing Baby First TV now on DirecTV. They say it's just like reading a book, but more engaging.
That's quite a claim. And I've looked over your materials, and it seems to suggest, at least in broad terms, that not only is Baby First not as bad for your kids as other TV, but that it's actually a positive step, that it's actually good for them.
I would not claim that Baby First TV in its own makes your baby smarter. That's a claim that we still need to prove. But I can say interaction between babies and parents does help a child develop. And that's exactly what Baby First TV is offering.
I have a 5-year-old, and she was brought up partly on these Baby Einstein videos. And I got to tell you, first of all, she ain't no Einstein. What she's learned is how to watch TV. She wants to watch as much as we will let her. Isn't that ultimately what Baby First teaches kids, that they like parking themselves in front of the tube?
Well, I cannot comment on your specific 5-year-old because I don't know her, which I'm sure she's a very lovely kid. But I can tell you the fact of life is that babies are watching TV, regardless of the existence of Baby First TV. Baby First TV offers an alternative that is tailor-made for their needs and ability, an alternative that does not contain inappropriate stimulations Nobody's flying. Nobody's dying. Nobody's puking. Nothing of that sort. So what we're giving them is a safe and clean alternative of watching high-quality programming tailor-made for the baby's needs.
Well, Sharon, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Sharon Rector is Executive Vice President of Baby First TV, the new channel for babies, launched earlier this month.
The children. We are all of us frightened for the children. And we have plenty of numbers to justify that fear, like a $20 billion child porn industry or 50,000 predators prowling for children online, numbers that resound endlessly through the media ether, origins unknown. Take that last number, 50,000 sexual predators logged in at any given time. That appeared late last year in a series for NBC's Dateline called To Catch a Predator. Last week, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez cited it. Legal Times noted that spokespersons for the FBI, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Crimes Against Children Research Center say it's not based on any research they're aware of. The AG's office said it came from Dateline.
It was attributed to, you know, law enforcement as an estimate, and it was talked about as sort of an extrapolated number.
Chris Hansen is a reporter for the Dateline series, still ongoing.
So when we went to interview Ken Lanning, who was the expert we talked to in our first piece, I said, look, this number keeps surfacing. Do you think that it's accurate, it's reliable? And he essentially said to me, I've heard it, but depending on how you define what is a predator, it could actually be a very low estimate.
He took that as confirmation, but maybe he shouldn't have.
I didn't know where it came from. I couldn't confirm it, but I couldn't refute it either. But I felt it was a fairly reasonable figure.
That's Hansen's source, FBI veteran Ken Lanning.
I was somewhat curious about the fact that it was 50,000. That number had popped up in the past because I had been an FBI agent for over 30 years. In the early 1980s, this was the number that was most often used to estimate how many children were kidnapped or abducted by strangers every year. But the research that was done in the early 1990s found that somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 to 300 children every year were abducted in this manner.
It seems bad things don't come in threes. They come in 50,000.
The other one that I specifically remember kind of came in the late 80s, where there were a lot of people who were talking about satanic cults that were supposedly running around the country engaging in human sacrifices. And when you try to say, well, how much of this is going on, once again, the same number popped up, 50,000 a year.
Sacrificed?
Yes, that's what they were alleging. This one here was a little bit more obviously problematic to me because we do have good data on homicide. And at that time, there was somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 23,000 murders every year. So this meant that the Satanists all by themselves were killing twice as many people as all the other murderers combined.
So why is 50,000 such an unaccountably sticky figure?
Maybe the appeal of the number was that it wasn't a real small number. It wasn't like 100, 200, and it wasn't a ridiculously large number like 10 million. It was like a Goldilocks number, not too hot, not too cold.
Carl Bialik tracks down dubious numbers in his column for the Wall Street Journal. He followed up that $20 billion child porn industry figure I quoted earlier, and it led him straight into a blind alley. Now, $20 billion is what Lanning might call a ridiculously large number, and despite multiple media citations and a long string of attributions, in the end, Bialik could find no research group or agency willing to claim ownership.
An interesting phenomenon of these numbers is that they'll often be cited to an agency or some government body, and then a study will pick it up, and then the press will repeat it from that study. And then once it appears in the press, public officials will repeat it again, and now it's become an official number.
And it actually displays a touching faith in the numbers supplied by the media.
It does. You know, often public officials will criticize the media, but when there's a number that squares with the stance they're going to take, then it's a great resource for them.
Especially when that stance is unassailable. For example,
I completely agree with their goal of protecting children, but they often will use dubious numbers to advance that goal. I think one of the reasons that this is allowed to continue to happen is that there isn't really a natural critic. Nobody really wants to go on the record saying, you know, it turns out this really isn't a big problem. because then you can be accused of being on the side of the sexual predators.
Steve Ross, a former professor at Columbia University School of Journalism who taught a class on reporting numbers, says journalists have their own reasons for ornamenting their stories with digits.
Look, 30, 40 years ago, ever since I've been in the business, the editor will come down to you and say, add a number, it builds credibility. Got to have a number in there.
But when it comes to crime, a good number is hard to find.
The only reasonably accurate national crime statistics come out of something called the Uniform Crime Report. The Uniform Crime Report only tracks 8 different crimes: rape, murder, auto theft, that sort of thing. If it's not a crime that is tracked, child pornography is not tracked, for instance, there is no hard and fast national number that comes out of that. The very best, it's a number that's extrapolated from a more limited survey.
Dateline reporter Chris Hansen.
There's a natural tendency to try to quantify a problem. I think we all do it.
So you think you'll continue to use that number?
We used it in the first 2 stories, and we haven't used it in the last 3.
But in terms of changing the previous stories, or I know that they may be rebroadcast at MSNBC, you'll just leave them as they stand.
Well, I don't think that decision's been made yet.
The strongest form of media bias is probably a reporter's bias for his or her own story.
Wall Street Journal numbers guy, Carl Bialik.
And when you find a number that backs up the thesis you've adopted for your story, it can be really hard to pass it up.
Add to that the mysterious allure of 50,000, applied to mayhem ranging from Korean War casualties to the annual death toll from secondhand smoke. I tossed it to former journalism prof Steve Ross. If I were to throw that number out to you as if it were a Jeopardy answer, what might you guess the question would be?
How many traffic deaths are there in the United States every year?
How about how many people are killed a year because of satanic human sacrifice?
I would doubt that it is very many. But I've heard 50,000.
The FBI's Fanning says there may well be 50,000 sexual predators trawling the net. He doesn't know. He does know that 50,000 is the Goldilocks of crime stats. But as experience shows, that doesn't mean it's just right.
Coming up, Iran gets some bad press it didn't deserve, and an unemployed editor seeks work after a life spent at Hustler.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last Friday, Canadians awoke to a shocker splashed across the front page of the National Post. The Conservative Daily reported that Iran's parliament had passed a law requiring all citizens to wear standard Islamic garments and all non-Muslims to wear color-coded badges signifying their religion. Jews would wear yellow, Christians red, Zoroastrians blue. The article was accompanied by a photo of a Hungarian Jewish couple in the 1940s with the Nazi-mandated stars sewn onto their coats. Bloggers leapt on the story, and Rush Limbaugh wasn't far behind.
In Iran, human rights groups, amazingly, are raising alarms over this. I don't recall human rights groups coming to the defense of Christians lately, but I guess they've got no choice here.
It is yet another sign, read a New York Post editorial the following day, that Iran is testing the rest of the world's resolve regarding Tehran's nascent nuclear weapons program, even as Hitler tested the will of Europe with his piecemeal territorial expansion in the run-up to World War II. Never mind that the story about the color-coded badges appears to have been completely false. On Saturday, the National Post ran a follow-up piece with outright denials from Iranian officials and experts, and on Wednesday, the paper's editor offered a 900-word apology. In it, he said the story's primary source was a column in the paper, also last Friday, by Iranian exile Amir Tahiri.
Tahiri is represented by Benador Associates, a public relations firm in New York run by Eliana Benador. Her client list reads like a who's who of neoconservative thinkers: Richard Perl, James Woolsey, and Michael Ledeen, among others. They published many op-ed column inches supporting regime change in the run-up to the Iraq War, thanks to Benador's help. As for Tahiri, he's sticking to his story about Iran's new dress code, and Eliana Benador is too.
I have not seen in that article anything wrong with that information. He says that there will be a new Iranian dress code, probably as of September, probably. For me, I think this is the bottom line. And, you know, people can distort it or look at it in their own way. You can have it black and white, and they will see yellow and green.
You know, I don't wish to quibble with you about the relative blackness of the sentence. It also envisages separate dress codes for religious minorities, Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians,
right,
who will have to adopt distinct color schemes to make them identifiable in public. But what raises my eyebrows about this whole incident is it is so eerily familiar to a story that was widely circulated during the lead-up to the first Gulf War about babies being thrown out of their incubators by Iraqi troops occupying Kuwait. A story that turned out to be a complete fabrication floated by a public relations agency that had as its client the Kingdom of Kuwait.
Yeah, well, I see your point. The only thing I can tell you is that our funds are never coming from any government. And if my experts give me articles that they feel they have to publish and that we submit them to editors, and if they feel this is important enough, we all are working on the same direction to try to protect the public. There is no warmongering here at all. But there are some instances where public opinion has to be alerted.
Now, Eliana, I don't wish to rub your nose in this, but I've got to say, in terms of being concerned and spreading the word before the invasion of Iraq, you and your clients were, you know, quite noisy about WMD. Now, those warnings have been discredited. Does this make you gun-shy about the Iran situation or no?
Well, we were not only speaking about weapons of mass destruction. We were speaking about also the massacres under Saddam Hussein. That was on behalf of human rights. Now, in my mind, I'm convinced that there were weapons of mass destruction. I mean, even Colin Powell presented that on our televisions. We could see what was brought up from intelligence. You know, again, this is a case where, you know, you have the facts in front of you and people just prefer not to believe in that.
Now that the Iraq War has proved to be so unpopular and widely regarded anyway as a complete fiasco, do you find centrist and left-of-center papers less hospitable to the work of your clients? Do you think that you've got a reputation for being so much a true believer that editors take you less seriously?
No, not at all. Not at all. But I have to say the administration is having a major problem in communicating with the American people. And the American people basically doesn't even remember why we are in Iraq, why we are in Afghanistan, why are we worried about Iran. You know, we're facing an enemy who has views, extreme views of his own religion, and he wants to come, conquer the West, make us convert to his version of religion, and make me, a woman from the West, dressed completely in black, not work. You know, I disagree with that. If this would be constantly explained to the people, you know, things would be much, much better for everybody.
So then to conclude, in the situation that we face now, when this theocratic repressive regime seems on the verge of actually being a nuclear power, and Tahrir comes up with a column like this, if it inflames the public, does it even matter to you whether the story is, strictly speaking, true?
It does matter. But the point is, number one, I believe what Amir wrote. He's a man of integrity who's been fighting for human rights, you know, throughout the Middle East. You know, I'm worried about the Iranian government and if they are going to do this. You know, if we are lucky and we stop it and they don't do any dress code, well, that will be, you know, a great outcome.
All right. Well, Eliana, thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
Eliana Benador is president of Benador Associates Public Relations in New York. She spoke to us from Zurich. And now a brief update as we continue to track the fallout from Janet Jackson's Nipplegate incident. On May 18th, the Senate voted unanimously for a bill that would significantly raise FCC fines for offending broadcasters, tenfold to be exact. The maximum is now $32,500 per offense, a figure that would increase to $325,000 if the bill is signed into law. Now the bill is headed to the House, and many predict that this version stands the best chance of making it to the president's desk. I asked Kansas Republican Sam Brownback, who authored the Senate bill, whether it's true that 2 years post-Janet, Congress just needs something to take back to constituents.
I don't think that's true. This is something that's been percolating around the system for a long time. It passed the last Congress, 98-1. The problem hasn't gone away. It keeps growing, but it has had a lot of dedicated subsurface opposition, and that's really slowed the process.
The FCC ruled pretty much that while I can't talk about my excretory functions without putting WNYC and our affiliate stations at risk, I can call somebody a dickhead with impunity. Now, isn't that kind of arbitrary for meting out $300,000 fines?
Like any process that has some judgment involved, there is a subjectivity in some degree, but they tried to set, and they did set, as objective standards as they can, and they are trying to send a message to the industry of, please, if you're going to use this license, you've agreed to a certain standard. And I think most people believe that the culture has substantially coarsened, and it's been moved along by television and radio, and they don't agree with that.
If this bill is signed into law by the president, will you stop here, or will you attempt perhaps to get similar regulation for cable, satellite, internet, and the various other channels that content can come into people's homes?
Well, the Supreme Court has determined that we cannot address the issues on cable because it is different. Now, they said that at a time when there wasn't the level of penetration of cable across the country, and it may be so pervasive now that they allow it. But most of those issues are dealt with on a community basis, based upon a community standard of decency. And I do think you're probably going to start to see more communities step up, taking back some of their culture on this basis that's allowed for by the court on community standards.
Okay, Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you. Y'all take care.
Sam Brownback is Republican Senator from Kansas.
That Senator Brownback invoked the phrase community standard is no accident. He's referring to a key part of the Miller test, the Supreme Court's legal definition for determining whether speech or expression can be labeled obscene. But perhaps the surest way to gauge community standards is to run afoul of them, which is what magazine publisher Larry Flint did in the mid-70s in Cincinnati, Ohio, where he faced down a local anti-pornography committee, and again in New Hampshire in the 1980s, and again in the 90s back in Ohio. Most of Flint's employees would swiftly come and go through the turmoil, but one man managed to stick around for nearly two decades. Alan McDonnell worked his way up from deckhand to editorial captain of Larry Flint Publications and has written a memoir of his voyage. It's called Prisoner of X, 20 Years in the Hole at Hustler Magazine. McDonnell says that around the office, one thing never changed.
There's not anybody who worked for Larry for more than 3 or 4 weeks who didn't do an imitation of him. It was just, you cannot resist it.
How did you end up at Hustler?
I wanted to write. I wanted to be a paid writer. And I live here in Los Angeles, and it was one of the few things that was open to me. I'd kind of crapped out of college. Plus, I really liked the stance of the magazine, where you could do whatever you want and say whatever you want.
Now, you developed a real talent for critical invective, which you employed to excellent effect as a triple X movie reviewer for one of Flint's subsidiary magazines. And I think one of my favorite lines of yours quoted in the book was when you referred to a director's effort as a, quote, talky, pretentious blop of slop, a cancer on the body of sleaze.
I had a lot of fun with that stuff because our goal was if the movie was really boring, well, then make the review at least more interesting than the movie. And it was kind of somewhat futile because, I mean, who read them? You know, no one read them and no one kept them. Certainly, there's not going to be a collection of my porn reviews ever put out, you know. But later on, there's a column in the magazine. It was set right up in the front of the magazine. The title of it was, you know, a bodily orifice that considered like a synonym for jerk. So it was this bodily orifice of the month. And that column was just pure invective, and it was written in the foulest language, but with very solid logic exposing, like, hypocrisy or some kind of double-dealing or just really bad behavior on the part of some kind of public figure. And I felt I was born to write that column.
I think for the sake of accuracy, let's call that feature A-hole of the Month, which is closer to what it's actually called. This was a real prime example of how Hustler related to media stars, to celebrities.
We didn't have to worry about pleasing any publicists because no celebrities were going to appear in our magazine or endorse our magazine. So we had a free hand to basically take the air out of these people, you know, in a way that no one else really does.
Now, that was Hustler's position because, as you say, no publicist was going to work with you anyway. Do you think that was also the perspective of your audience? How do you see your average reader?
You know, he's either in prison or he's in junior high, you know. So think of someone kind of like you. And by you, I mean me and the people I would hire. Like, at any time, I would have a staff of 8 or 10 people, you know, men and women. You know, as kids, they'd loved Mad Magazine. They'd loved, like, the early National Lampoons. So generally, there are people who came in with this sort of skewed perspective on what the mass culture was presenting to us. I read Mark Twain religiously from the age of, like, 10 or 12. And he had this kind of viewpoint all the way through. So I've got to assume that it's a standard American audience, because Mark Twain was a very popular writer. And so there's this kind of an American
wait
kind
a minute,
of...
Wait a minute. Are you actually comparing the oeuvre that, if you look back over the issues, Hustler might comprise to that of Mark Twain?
When I would read Mark Twain, like the things he would say about politicians, and the excellent misanthropy, I mean, the way he pointed out these negative characteristics in everybody, that kind of thing is what I'm saying. We were a continuation of that kind of satirical bent.
As you note in the book, Larry Flint seemed to go in and out of the day-to-day management of the magazine based essentially on his pain level, his health, his various surgeries. Mm-hmm. How did that affect you when you became editor?
Well, initially, it was kind of rough because he was very heavily medicated, probably for my first 2 or 3 years. But then Larry, he met his nurse named Liz. Through her influence, he went into a rehab and he got off the drugs. And he came back and he announced that now that he was clear of the drugs, his primary focus would be on restoring the edge to Hustler. And people just looked around and kind of smirked at me like, you're dead, you're gone. But somehow Larry and I, we ended up bonding. Because I had, before he came back, I had run it on his template. You know, it's the whole chip on your shoulder kind of deal.
And it probably found its fullest expression during the Clinton years. That was the magazine's crusade in the run-up to President Clinton's impeachment.
What we set out to do was to prove that the Republican legislators who were waging this so-called moral crusade against Bill Clinton had just as many moral failings, if not more. And what we did is we went trolling. We put an ad in the Washington Post and we offered $1 million to anyone who could come forward with proof validating that they had had an adulterous affair with a high-placed government member. We didn't specify whether Republican or Democrat. And we placed that ad on a Sunday, and on a Monday, we had about 8,000 responses. We hit pay dirt.
A couple of times.
Well, the biggest one we got was the Speaker-elect, Bob Livingston from Louisiana. He eventually resigned because we insinuated that we had information on him having affairs.
Which you didn't actually have.
We had nothing on Livingston. What happened is we got one phone call, and they said, this is the phone number of Bob Livingston's girlfriend. And the woman, she told us to, you know, go mind our own business. And then she hung up on us.
And with that indicting evidence, you insinuated that Livingston was having an affair. And he resigned, thus apparently proving your point.
Within an hour and a half, Livingston was given a press conference saying he'd been Larry Flinted.
What will you do now?
What will I do now? About 3 weeks after I got fired, I was looking on Media Bistro, seeing what kind of jobs were available. And they had an interview with Art Cooper, the longtime GQ editor. And he was talking about the time when he had been at Penthouse, because he ran Penthouse for a short time. And he said the sign that came to him that he had to get out of Penthouse was when another magazine came along, a disgusting magazine called Hustler. And he knew that he had to move on. And when I read this guy, he was being inducted in the Magazine Hall of Fame, refer to my entire resume as the disgusting magazine called Hustler, I knew I was going to have some opposition to, you know, overcome.
What do you think would be the perfect job to follow this one?
I'd like to move into radio.
Really?
I think I'd be pretty good in radio, yeah. Yeah, they took in G. Gordon Liddy. They took in that the Marine who sold
Oliver North.
Arms to Oliver North. There's room for me in radio, I think.
The media employer of last resort, perhaps.
Maybe.
Well, welcome to the biz, Alan.
Thank you.
But before you go, tell me, how did you get fired?
Well, I was drafted to perform at a roast of Larry Flint. And I did not get the memo that by roast they meant tribute. And I went in there and I did a pretty stiff roast. And within about 2 or 3 months, I was out.
Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You've been kind to me.
Alan McDonnell is the author of Prisoner of X, 20 Years in the Hole at Hustler Magazine.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Mark Phillips and Ani Katz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.